This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by FreshBooks. Check out your free 30-day trial at freshbooks.com/TDI.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of The Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
GDP misses the mark. Dollar continues to plunge. IBD's top brokers announced, and our guest today, Brian Shannon from alphatrends.net and author of Technical Analysis Using Multiple Timeframes. All this and much more on episode number 545 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a very warm welcome to all of you that are listening and have been here for a long time. Those of you that are newbies, first timers, recent timers, hey, thanks for joining me. And of course, all of you that have been around for years and years and years, you know, it's much appreciated. And thanks for the insight. And by the way, we got some great emails in and great guest suggestions. We have a tremendous amount of new podcast reviews that came in. And book recommendations. I got all of those. So definitely we're going to check all those out. Keep them coming. Make sure to spend some time keeping me in the loop so that I know what's going on from you. I love hearing from you. You know that. Anybody that's written to me in the past, you know I try to write to you right away or within a reasonable amount of time and answer your questions. And, you know, it's much appreciated. Go over to the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and just click on one of the buttons on the top, Ask Andrew or Podcast Reviews, and you can put all that in there, and I appreciate it. It's important for me to get some feedback from you, so make sure that if you haven't done so, to spend a couple of minutes doing that. What I thought we'd do is start the show looking back at last week, what went on, and some insights into what we're going to expect this week. And we didn't see a lot of economic activity last week from the aspect of reports in the U.S., but there were a few that were kind of important, and we'll start right with the big daddy that we saw on Friday, which was GDP. And we saw that the first estimate of fourth quarter GDP was actually lower than the third quarter of 2017. Now, this is just the first estimate, and oftentimes we see that being revised up, at least historically we have. But still, it is lighter than there was last quarter or the previous quarter. And in addition to that, probably more importantly, it was significantly lower than was expected. Expectations were somewhere around about 3%, and it came in at 2.6%. Now, this is above the average that we've seen over the last number of years, which was running at about 2.1% over the last 8 years. So 2.6 is a good number. But the bottom line is when we look at 2017 on a year basis, we're looking at 2.3% overall growth. And again, this was supposed to be a bit higher, so I'm not sure what happened there, what held it back. There were a few things, though, that actually helped. We saw that there was a really good amount of consumer spending. In fact, it was some of the best consumer spending that we've seen in some time that was embedded in that report. Inventory levels are growing a bit, so that's kind of looking at the manufacturing area that's really pumping out the goods, but not keeping up, I guess, is the consumer, even though they're spending, not keeping up with the actual, the amount of inventory that's out there. Or you could say that possibly the end retailer that gets the manufactured goods is keeping things pretty lean. They don't want to be stuck with things on the shelf just in case. They'd rather have less on the shelves, maybe even have some pricing opportunity to increase prices if, in fact, they are running low on goods. So there was some things there that were really positive in the report. And there were some things that were a little bit negative. So kind of a mixed bag in terms of the GDP. Now, are we going to reach 3% on an annualized basis in 2018? Well, if we're supposed to have such a great first quarter, I'm not exactly sure how we're going to get there. We're not that far off. I mean, 2.6% to 3% for the first quarter, not terrible. But still, we're far below all the excitement and the commentary from all these economists that thought, yeah, we're going to hit this 3%. I mean, it's going to take some time. Now, whether or not the optimism over the tax cuts and the flow down of better income due to the fact that there's less withholding on a lot of people's paychecks and there's bonuses that are being paid out, and we're going to see capital infrastructure spending and CapEx spending, et cetera. I mean, a lot of that could definitely flow in. Dividends that are being raised, a lot of things that are really good. Most of it showing up, of course, in the stock market. And we'll just kind of skip right to that point. And we did see that it was a great week. Right there. I mean, it was a great week. We saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average up about 2.09%, coming into that, getting close to that 27,000 mark. The S&P was up 2.23%, closing in on 3,000. It's right now at 2872. What's interesting about this number, this 2872 or 2850 or so, that level, that was pretty much the consensus estimates for the year-end value for the S&P 500. Think about that. So here we are. We're not even finished with January yet. And here we are already hitting the consensus levels for the S&P 500 for year end. Now, a lot of things can happen. We've also heard, of course, the old adage that, what happens in January, so goes the year. There is this concept that, you have January up, January down. Well, that's kind of how it's going to play out for the rest of the year. There's a lot of statistics that back this. Say, about 87% of the time, if January's up, the rest of the year is up. The problem is that you have to really look at this in the context. So if you see that January was up, let's say, 10%, does that mean that, the rest of the year starts falling down? And if we end the year up 5%, it's still saying, we were up for the year, we were up for January, so check, that works. I'm not exactly sure about this. We've seen so many times it break. And don't forget, 87% of the time, markets on an annual basis have been up, 78% of the time on an annual basis over the last 50 years? So I think really this is just a way of spinning in the statistics, which we've seen so many times. I think it's an interesting thing to talk about, an interesting thing to look at, but I don't know if it really plays out necessarily. I would like to see that the statistic that shows that when January is up, that the rest of the year is up and it is higher than January. So that if in January the S&P was up, let's say 5%, that the rest of the year is up, but it has to be up at least 6%, let's say. It has to be over the level of where it was in January. And I'd even like to see what the general trend was throughout the year. But again, I don't find that so important. It's interesting to look at. It's interesting to play with. It's a nice chart, a nice talking point. But really, does that get us anywhere? I mean, a lot of things can happen. You could see things turn around very quickly in March. I don't know why, but something may happen. Who knows? And all of a sudden, the year changes. The tone changes. The sentiment changes. And there's a change in the dynamic of what happens to the markets. And what does this 1 month have to do with anything? I would venture to say probably if you picked another month and you said, in March, if the markets were up in March, then on average, the years are up too. I mean, that would probably correlate pretty well. But I just don't think that's really something we should pay attention to in a big way. Again, talking point, interesting way of looking at things and deciding what's happening from a statistical standpoint. Interesting, but nothing that I'm going to bet my money on in terms of the whole year. All right, what else do we have? We saw that home sales came out last week as well. The National Association of Retailers saw a 3.6% slump in existing home sales. And new home purchases actually dropped by about 9.5% last month. Now, we saw that during 2017, so now we're past this, we can get the full year data. 2017, there was a 1.1% increase in existing home sales. And interestingly, new home sales were up about 8.3% over the year. Good numbers. So this housing recovery continues. And we've seen that with the Case-Shiller numbers, which will actually come out this week. The Case-Shiller 20 numbers, I believe, is on Tuesday. We'll go through some of the things in a minute on that. Now, we also saw that oil Crude oil, WTI, reached $66 a barrel. And this is the highest price that we've seen in about 3 years. Seen about, I think, 5 of the last 6 weeks that crude oil was rising. So a lot of this has to also do with the fact that we're seeing the continuation of a slump in the U.S. dollar. And Treasury Secretary Mnuchin's comments out of Davos last week didn't help at all. You remember those comments where he said something to the effect that, well, a low dollar or, you know, a dollar at lower levels is actually beneficial to the U.S. from a trade and economic standpoint. Yeah, that's true, but that's not something you usually hear from a Treasury Secretary. Oftentimes you've heard for the last 30 years probably, you know what? A strong dollar is in the best interest of the United States. Now, behind the scenes, something different. Because one of the things that we've always done is we've been labeling others as currency manipulators and using their currency as a weapon from an economic standpoint. And we promise not to do that. Meanwhile, Mnuchin makes this comment. The dollar drops even further, sub 90 on the Dixie. And it had to be walked back by both the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, and the president had to say, no, this is taken out of context. No, misunderstood what he said. I mean, I don't know about you. If you read it word for word, what he said, even with or without the paragraph before or the paragraph after, Mnuchin clearly was talking down the dollar. At least he wasn't talking it up. And the other thing that's important, and President Trump actually said this, and it was pretty good of him to say that, you know, we're not supposed to be really talking about the dollar anyway. It's not something we should be getting involved with. Let the markets handle the value. And then we have to jump back to the other thing. You know, what's going on with the dollar going down with all the other things that should be actually help support the dollar? For example, we have the Fed slowing down on their stimulus, potentially raising rates. We have a strong economy. We have a good jobs number, a solid market. I mean, all these good things should actually favor a nation and the nation's currency, but it's not happening. So again, I think we talked about this last week. This could be just all part of this massive risk on trade where we're saying, hey, you know what? Let's short the dollar because, you know, we're not too concerned about the dollar moving up here. And let's go into things like emerging market currencies or European, or let's, you know, bet the fact that we could take some of this and do a carry trade and possibly move into other very risky assets without the worry that the dollar is going to have any significant moves higher. Because, you know, it's just been one of these slow movers. Now it's down about 10% in the last year, and that has helped out and provided a massive amount of benefit for many companies. We know that, and oil and gold and commodities. So I'll have to watch this and see how this plays out. But I'm kind of curious, you know, when Mnuchin talked about it and the dollar dropped, and when Wilbur Ross then mentioned, hey, it's been taken out of context and misunderstood. And then President Trump talked about it. The dollar actually did pick up a little bit, but then started to roll over again. Don't forget, you got a lot of currency traders right now that are sitting on the short side of this, looking at the U.S. as, while it's strong, the net effect of a Japanese plan to possibly slow down stimulus and the ECB saying that the European economy has gotten a lot stronger. Well, what's that going to do? Well, it's going to be significant in terms of that valuation moving higher. So maybe it's just a trade out of those, out of the U.S. dollar and short the euro, short the yen, into, you know, rotating the opposite way. Now, we have a lot of earnings that are coming up and a variety of economic numbers. A big week, actually, for economic numbers. Before we do that, I want to talk about just really quickly something I really like. And that is, you've heard me talk about last few weeks, is FreshBooks. Because one of the things that, you know, as an individual in a small business, small to mid-sized business, there's a lot of things that are actually, well, they're cumbersome. They're difficult to deal with. Unnecessary. Things that you can automate. And if you haven't done so already, you're still dealing with, you know, writing checks out and have these, maybe an Excel spreadsheet that's looking for where your invoices that are outstanding are and how much do you have in terms of accounts receivable and accounts payable and, you know, what's happening in the world of your quotes that you have outstanding. Well, FreshBooks has an amazing way of simplifying all that for you. It's a great interface that's used, very easy to use, really well laid out. And again, you can create invoices on the fly with easy to use templates they have. They have an integrated payment system. You can do estimates and project management, billing, invoicing. You can do profit and loss statements for your business. You can set up reminders and notes and client information. There's a lot of things. And it can be used, obviously, by a lot of people in your office to make sure that, you know, anybody can keep on top of what's going on. It's a really, really easy program to use and system to use. It's all in the cloud. It has a lot of powerful features. So you can get yourself up and running really quickly. You can make your life a lot easier. You can spend your time doing the things that actually make you money, and as opposed to doing all this paperwork and an extra amount of things that really take you away from doing what you do best. I want you to check out FreshBooks. You get a 30-day free trial by simply going to freshbooks.com/TDI. And you can put in the Discipline Investor if you like to make sure you get that in the How Did You Hear About Us section. I encourage you just to check it out. You get a 30-day free trial. So even if you're doing something that you are comfortable with and you like and you know, do me a favor. Check them out. I mean, they are sponsors of the show, and we want to make sure to work with these great sponsors, freshbooks.com/TDI. There's also links on the website, so make sure you check those out. Really, really great product. And getting back to some of the things we are going to talk about, before we get to our guest today, I'm going to talk about some of the things we have to expect for the coming week. And then after we talk with our guest, I want to talk about some of my reading that I did this weekend. And in particular, there was some great articles in some papers, some financial papers I haven't read in a while, but some things that I found out I thought was really interesting. So stick around for that right after we talk with the guest. We'll get into that, into more depth into some of these things and a couple of surprises, in some of my reading. All right, what do we have coming up here? Let's see. On Monday, we have some economics, the personal spending. We also have earnings coming from Lockheed Martin and Seagate. There's some question. Western Digital kind of did a loop-de-loop last week. With Seagate and Western Digital being the two majors in the drive business, in the storage business, with all the cloud that's going on, it's going to be interesting to see how they play out. On Tuesday, we're going to see the Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index. Remember last week, I think it was, we saw that there was a drop in the Michigan sentiment. I don't know if that's going to carry through, but it will be really interesting to see if there is a change in overall consumer sentiment moving forward, because we've seen that there's been such a high level for such a long time. The optimism about the outlook in the current and present situation has been really high. And I wonder if, for whatever reason, everybody's just like, okay, well, now we got what we wanted. We're fine now. Nothing really necessarily to be optimistic about, nothing to be negative about, but we'll just see. So I think that's going to be something we need to pay attention to. We also have earnings from Aetna and Chubb, Corning, Electronics Arts, Harley Davidson, which has had a little bit of a rocky year. McDonald's is going to be coming out as well. Estimates have been lowered for them recently. We'll see Wednesday. The Federal Reserve is going to wrap up a policy meeting, and we're going to see pending home sales, ADP payrolls, and earnings from AT&T, Boeing, Citrix, D.R. Horton, Facebook, MetLife, Microsoft, PayPal, Qualcomm, U.S. Steel, and Xerox. On Thursday, we're going to see the ISM's factory numbers, the PMI for January, along with earnings from Google or Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, AutoNation. We're going to see GoPro and International Paper, MasterCard, Nokia. Who else is on here? Time Warner, Valero, and Visa. And then Department of Labor is coming out with their jobs report, the all official jobs report for the first Friday of the month, because we're into February already by then. And estimates are probably close to about the just shy of the 200,000 mark, with about a 4.1% overall unemployment rate. And we're going to have earnings also from Chevron, Clorox, ExxonMobil, Sony, and Sprint. So it's an action. There's hundreds and hundreds of companies that are reporting. It's a big week. I mean, you have all the major tech names that will be reporting this week. Now, that will have some interesting impact on markets. No question about that, right? When you have Apple, which, by the way, several different reports and analysts have come out cutting Apple's outward guidance. They believe that there has been a slowdown significant enough in the 8 and the iPhone X to cause them to reduce their estimates. And we're seeing that there also has been reports out of some of the suppliers that have said that they're actually going to be reducing their guidance. Therefore, a follow through and a pass through to what's happening with Apple. And the question is going to be, you know, are they going to be able to meet their numbers? Oh, I think so. What about the outlook? How much lower than expectations, which have already been lowered, are they going to actually say is going to be the case? They have the HomePod, that part of that's going to be included, but clearly the iPhone 8 and the iPhone X will both be included in this quarter's results. We're also going to find out whether or not the change in the newsfeed and some of the spending that has been dropped by many advertisers will hurt Facebook. It hasn't hurt so far, but this story about changing how the newsfeed works with the organic news that's being provided by many of the advertisers that use that and pay for has been changed dramatically. And the question is going to be what's going to do their outlook. So that's going to be also interesting. And of course, Amazon's going to be a major mover of markets. I'm also keeping a watch on Pitney Bowes in the middle of the week. I use Pitney Bowes products. It's terrible. Terrible service, terrible organization, horrible billing structure. They never seem to get it right. And I just continue to wonder if Pitney Bowes is going, PBI is a symbol on that, if they're going to be able to make their numbers. They've actually been climbing pretty well lately. There's been some discussion about private equity that's looking to take a piece. But, you know, you hear those kind of rumors and, you know, with the stock that's down so much, you have to wonder whether that is just what it is, a pump and dump scheme trying to keep the stock up. So all these things are going to be playing out very soon in a stock market near you. All right. So, and I think I mentioned GoPro as well. So a lot of earnings, a lot of things that are going to be really coming to the front this week. And while we have not really seen a significant amount of blowback on any of the, whether it's geopolitical, whether it is softening economics in some areas or not. And by the way, if you look at, I put this out, I think we put this out last week, which is the Horowitz Company first quarter economic commentary and review. We put it out every quarter for the last, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 years. And it's meant for clients, but we actually will give it to, we wait a little while, give it to clients first, and then, you know, talk about some of the things that are going on. Now, these days, we used to have, you know, a 15-page piece that we put out because, you know, how else do you communicate with, you know, just to get things out there. These days, we don't write as much reports. You know, we do interim reports. We have private websites designed for clients where we write to them almost every day, specifically for the TDI Managed Growth Strategy and the Aero Strategy. So, you know, all of our clients are kept up in the loop. And whereas we do that over the last, I don't know, 5-7 years, because we're able to have this kind of technology. The fact is we don't have to write as much anymore because it's just going to be a regurgitation of the same things. But anyway, in this particular discussion, we talked about three things really that are really important, but two major issues. One is the mean reversion trade, the concept that possibly we're looking at the start of value and the value side of the stock market, looking as it could be ripe for a return to best growth. Why would that happen? Well, there's a lot of different reasons why that's in there. We also talked about, you know, the whole idea in there that, you know, the Citibank Economic Surprise Index, the ESI, you know, that's basically a way to look at what analysts are expecting in terms of economic numbers and actually what the results came out as. And I went into a discussion of how this really plays out with analysts that are trying to chase numbers and be right, and what then happens with the Citibank Economic Surprise Index, how it plays out. And then what happens when they're wrong and they have to catch up either direction. And right now what we've seen up until the beginning of 2018 is that the Citibank Economic Surprise Index has pretty much been moving straight up. In other words, analysts have been wrong on the downside. Economic numbers and reports have been coming out better than what they expected. Now what's happening is just starting 2018, it's sharply moving lower, which is part of the discussion I have here in this whole analysis of what's going on, how it works, how it plays out, how the cycles work. So if you haven't gotten your copy yet, make sure to get on one of our lists. We send it out to all the different lists there. And you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and a little pop-up comes up and you can put your name in there and I'll make sure to get it out there, or we'll put a special link on one of the upcoming podcasts so you can get that copy and you can be on the list of people to get it moving forward. And our guest today is Brian Shannon, and he's the founder, and he is with something called alphatrends.net, which you got to check out. Also the author of Technical Analysis Using Multiple Timeframes, and he's a top educator in the area of technical analysis. You know, one of the things, Brian, I've told you this, when your book came out a number of years ago, I said it was the most incredible book in terms of technical analysis. First of all, for the colors, seriously. You know, I thought, I'm not kidding about this either. I'm not making light of it. The colors and the use of that to really depict the charts very clearly, I thought was just great. Plus, it was kind of oversized. You know, it's not like one of those small little books. It's like, you know, longer. So you kind of get all your stuff in there. So great book. If you haven't checked it out, you can go over to Brian's site or anywhere else and get analysis, the book on technical analysis using multiple timeframes. Anyway, Brian, how are you?
Andrew, thanks for having me. It's been such a long time, and thanks for the kind words about the book.
Yeah, you know when the last time you were on actually is?
I don't. Probably 3 years ago.
Yeah, it was like 3 or 4 years ago. The first time you were on was May of 2008.
Wow.
And, you know,
we're old.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Old timers in this market. You know, you've been on several times since. And as a matter of fact, we're still, the good news is that this podcast is one of the longest running independent financial podcasts. And you're one of the guys that made it happen from being with us from the beginning. So I appreciate that.
Well, thanks for having me on. And it's always a great conversation talking to you. I'm looking forward to this discussion today.
So let's talk about, I want to talk about the two things and kind of merge them together. I want to talk about decrypting cryptocurrency charts and the concept of, well, can I use just charts for this? And I want to talk to you generally about technical analysis. So let's talk about the idea of charting and technical analysis first. So tell me and explain to me, you know, what does a chart tell you and how do you use them?
Well, there's a lot of ways to use a technical chart, and I am a chartered market technician. So I have that designation that supposedly makes me an expert. It means I pass some tests and that sort of thing. But, you know, I think a lot of people get hung up on the academics of technical analysis and, you know, looking for patterns and looking for things to specifically repeat in the same way. To me, a price chart, regardless of what market you're trading, represents the psychology of the participants. Who's in control, the buyers or the sellers? Who's gaining control and losing control? And what I want to do when I look at a chart and try to trade it is say, one, does the chart make sense? If it doesn't make sense, then I'm just going to ignore that and move on to the next chart, whatever that might be, whether it be if the S&P doesn't make sense to me, then I won't look at the S&P. If the cryptos are making sense, then and I see what appears to be a low risk, high probability trade. And I define that by levels on the chart. Is there what appears to be a good risk reward ratio? Am I going to be able to risk a small amount to hopefully make a much bigger amount of money if the chart does unfold the way that I'm wanting it to? But if not, then I get stopped out for a small loss, reassess, and wait for another setup or move on to something else.
So, you know, talking about psychology, that's interesting. So let's talk about what you just said. So you enter a trade, whatever the particular symbol is or market, whatever it may be, and you say, okay, here's my upside, here's my downside on this. And, you know, you get into that trade. I don't know what happens. Something happens and you get stopped out, right? Now, a lot of people will be like, I'm not going back to that. So how do you deal with the psychology of like, okay, I lost on that one, wipe it clean, and if it sets up the same way again, I'm going right back to it.
Yeah, it can be frustrating, I'll tell you the truth, at times. Sometimes you wonder, am I being stubborn or am I being persistent? And the answer to that question depends on the outcome of the second or third time that you try it. So sometimes, you know, the market just might not be making sense for whatever reason. And if they're not trading, you know, in what appears to be a low risk way, well, the beauty of it is that let's say I try the stock three times in a row, I get stopped out twice for small losers, but then that third time I make a nice winner. We all know the mathematics of, you know, a good risk reward, that you can be right one out of three times. And let's say you lose, you know, one unit of risk twice, but you make five times on that third trade, or even three times on that third trade, you're still going to come out ahead.
Right.
So it goes down to the basics of what everybody knows, but is difficult to do, which is to cut your losers quickly and let your winners run.
You know, one of the things I think is really interesting, it's very hard to do, is to look at a chart and not know what particular instrument you're looking at, and then make a determination on the entry or exit based on just the chart. So, you know, what I mean by that is, so, you know, you look at a chart and you're like, oh, this is Apple. Well, Apple's a good company, and Apple this and Apple that. Or you look at a different chart and you're like, oh, that's this. That's not a good company. I'm not going to invest in it. And how do you get away from that psychology?
Well, that's a really good point, because there's a lot of times where even a more familiar type of situation might be, hey, you know what, the market is a little bit funky here the last few days, but this is a really good setup, whether it be an Apple or a different type of stock that you don't know much about. So what I like to do is then look at it in terms of money management. We have risk management on the individual trade, saying if I get stopped out, it's going to be, you know, below the most recent relevant higher low, going with the definition of a trend rather than, you know, a random percentage for a stop. So if I am able to hold that stock and the risk reward looks good, but I'm a little unsure about the market, then it comes down to money management. If I normally, let's say as a swing trader, maybe you're going to risk, you know, $500 or $1,000 per trade, what I will do is say, I don't really feel confident about the market. We're in a heightened sense of uncertainty, so I'm going to scale back my position size. Rather than trading, you know, two units of risk, I'm going to trade one unit of risk. And that way you're still in the trade based on what that trade is telling you objectively looking at the chart, but because you have some other, you know, uncertainty again about the market. Maybe it's earnings season and you're a little bit uncertain because their competitor is about to report earnings. I've kicked myself in so many times missing what was a good trade because I was worried about the market. So instead, I look at it now, and it took me years to get to this point where I say, well, I still like the setup, and you know, all things considered, I would like to take this trade, but there is an overriding sense of uncertainty, so I'm going to trade it with smaller share size. That way, when the stock does go up, you know, if you were right, then you don't feel like a dope for doubting your beliefs and your systems and your strategies for trading based on technicals.
So now also, you're a big fan, and I know this because you write about this a lot, and I follow you on Twitter, which is Alpha Trends, by the way. If anybody wants to follow Brian on Twitter, it's at, you know, the handle is Alpha Trends, of the VWAP. Now, by the way, I think you've seen some of the stuff we do with regard to Market Profile, that we have plugins for TradeStation.
Yes.
But you do VWAP. Now, I have some specific questions because I do a lot of calculations of these similar kinds, you know, volume weighted at price. But one of the things I want to know is, first of all, explain VWAP, and then also how do you calculate it?
Okay, it's actually pretty simple. Volume weighted average price is kind of what it sounds like. It represents as a moving average on a chart. You can calculate it from any period, any starting period. So let's say we're talking about 1 day. If you start your chart, let's say a 1 minute chart, and I know that's not what most people are doing, but I'm just using this for the example of creating it. If at 9:30 a.m., the market opens and it trades 1,000 shares at $10. Well, the average price, you know, for the day so far is $10. Now, let's say we have $20,000 worth traded at 10:06. Well, now the volume weighted average price will be the dollar amount divided by the volume. So the average price would now be 10:04. So what it does is it takes all the volume for the period that you're looking at, multiplies each minute by the price that it traded at, then it divides them up and says, here's the average cost or average transaction price that the stock was transacted at for whatever period of time. So, you know, some people will use it for day trading on a 1 minute chart. I'll look at it for swing trading. I want to know the volume weighted average price from the most recent, thrust higher or for the most recent pullback. I think that, you know, the volume profile is actually, you know, can even give you a little bit further insight into the volume weighted average price, that they complement each other because they're both measuring, you know, volume at price, how much price was traded at any level. And the more volume that's traded there, it said that price has memory. So the more it trades at a particular level, the more likely that level is to be a potential level of support or resistance. And if that level is broken, then it's most likely going to be able to sustain a trending move.
Yeah, but the reason why I ask this is because I've done a variety of different calculations of VWAP, and you can see it, even though it's pretty simple, I get that. You know, the concept of calculating this is relatively simple. However, for example, if I want to look back a year, you know, you get evaluating average price on a daily chart, and you're going to get daily volume times the amount, right? Well, okay, that's daily. I've seen where you don't want to do 5 days, and maybe you can use, I'm picking a number, 15-minute bars to calculate what it is. Is there a right number, a right bar length to calculate this?
Well, that's a great question. In technical analysis, we have the science of technical analysis, and then when we have the art of technical analysis.
Oh, I hate that part.
And applying it to the market to where it makes sense. So let me give you a really good example about that, which is I'll look at the year-to-date volume-weighted average price. So here we are about 23 days into the trading year in terms of days traded. So on day number one, you know, the true volume weighted average price uses every single trade. So it'll use a tick trade.
Right.
But, you know, after 10 days, you have so many ticks, it just becomes, you know, it doesn't become mind boggling, but it doesn't become as important to have it based on ticks. The longer you go out in time, so for instance, on a year-to-date volume-weighted average price right now, I'm currently using 15-minute candles for that, and I'm about to switch over to 30, mainly because when I look at a 15-minute chart in 23 days of trading data right now, the chart is pretty compressed, meaning you can't see the candles as good. Mm-hmm. So if I switch it to a 30-minute time frame, I can start to see it a little bit better. And you don't need that same accuracy because it's each individual. We have so many points of data that one little individual piece of data can get rounded off a little bit more easily and still retain its value.
Right. So that's the art part.
Right, that's the art part. And for me, like for instance, with the year-to-date volume-weighted average price, I'll look at it. I'm probably going to switch over to, like I said, the 30-minute time frame. And once that chart gets a little bit too compressed, I'll go to a 65-minute time frame and then a 130-minute time frame and then keep moving up in time frames until probably about the third quarter of the year, I will be looking at daily candles for that year-to-date volume-weighted average price.
So explain 65 versus 60.
Good question. This is something that I thought about a while ago that I look at 30-minute time frames because the market's open from 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. So we're talking about equities here. In a market where we have 9:30 to 4 o'clock, that means there are 13 30-minute increments. Okay, there's that's 6.5 hours of trading. Well, in 6.5 hours of a trading day, if I look at an hourly chart, I'm going to basically have 7 candles. But the problem with those 7 candles are the first candle is 9:30 to 10 o'clock.
Right.
Then it goes from 10 to 11, 11 to 12, 12 to 1, et cetera. So you're looking at one 30-minute candle, which we'll call an apple, and you're looking at six 60-minute candles, which we'll call oranges. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows you don't compare apples to oranges.
Right. Yeah, right, exactly.
So I want to look at six apples or six oranges, whatever you prefer. So each day, 390 minutes of trading divided by six, divided by 65 gives you six equal candles. Uh-huh. They each are the same amount of data. And it's not so important with price, but once you start adding things like a MACD or a moving average or anything, you're not getting the true representation because you're overweighting one piece of that data by you're giving that first half hour of the day double weighting, which is random and arbitrary.
Right. And this is why actually in one of our indicators that we've built, we build it on 30-minute candles. So in other words, the 60-minute candle is built on 30 minutes, or the 240 or whatever, or the daily and the weekly actually are built on 30-minute candles.
Yeah, perfect. So you're doing it, you know, with the same reason, and you're building in a little hack basically.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so let's talk about one last thing, and I want to get into this whole idea of some of these cryptos here. So, well, two things actually. So moving averages. There's a lot of different moving averages. We know the theory of, okay, the 50-day moving average and for, you know, markets and the 200 and the 100, and some people use 150s and all. Tell me the importance of moving averages.
So what we're trying to essentially do is look at what is the crowd looking at, because they tend to be self-fulfilling at times. Think about the 50-day moving average. That's one that I've asked the question. How many people have a 50-day moving average on their chart? Mm-hmm. Most people who say they use moving averages, let's say 90%+ of the people using moving averages will say, yes, I have a 50-day. And I will say, well, what's the magic to the 50-day moving average? Is it because it doesn't even make sense? I mean, you could maybe say that's a quarter, right, 10 weeks, but it's really not a quarter of trading. So what's the magic of the 50-day other than that's what I was told to do because I read books about it and I see all these professionals talking about the 50-day moving average. But the key to really understanding what it means beyond the rising 50-day moving average tends to act as support, why is that? Hmm. Well, if you think about the participants, let's say there's a hedge fund that's watched this stock go from 30 to 45, and now the stock is 15% above its rising 50-day moving average. They're going to say, hey, we like this company, but there's an opportunity here to short it. Let's put a lid on this stock, short it down, and once it gets to the 50-day moving average, we'll look to cover it.
Right.
Because they're looking for those aggressive, counter trend trades. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you've got a big institution or two that own the stock from, $20 a share, and they've maybe been taking some profits into this extra nice real recent upswing, and they'll say, "Listen, we had 1 million shares, we sold 75,000 shares from 40 to 45. Now we'll sell a little bit more, but once it gets down towards that 50-day moving average, we're going to stop selling it." Well, think about what that does to the supply and demand equation.
Right.
When we have less sellers down at the 50-day moving average, the institution isn't selling anymore, the hedge fund isn't selling anymore, and instead the hedge fund is saying, "Hey, we're buying back here."
Right. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way, and then it's a default level that's put on the charts. Plus, it's projected and telegraphed out there that's important. Plus, there is some things that are happening. For example, there may be that hedge fund that says, I'm going to stay short for a while, but you know what? Let's take some profits. And then if it goes up again, we'll short again. However, they're kind of, it's kind of, like you said, just the psychology of the whole process. And then the level of just assumption of, okay, well, that's something important.
Exactly. And it's about the psychology of the participants and how many people have been trained. Pullbacks to the rising 50-day moving average tend to bounce. So you'll see sidelines money come in for that purpose only.
Right.
What I like to do is look at and say the 50-day moving average is a nice reference point. I understand the psychology of what often happens there. But the key word there is often happens. It's not every single time this is going to happen.
Yeah.
So what we want to do is we want to learn to anticipate what might happen at that 50-day moving average and say, okay, I've got that one on my list. Now I'm going to stalk this trade. I'm going to look at it on shorter time frames, maybe the 30-minute time frame, with a 15-day horizon, and look for signs that it's actually done going down. It's starting to turn sideways. And that's where I anticipate and build my plan and say, if it now breaks above $32.85, that's been the high of the last 5 days, then I will buy because the intermediate term trend is now making a higher high. That's in alignment with the longer term uptrend.
Right.
And now I can hopefully participate in that because it's back on the upswing, the trends are aligned, and I can do so with risk, you know, maybe a dollar or a dollar 50 away, mm-hmm. whatever the most recent higher low is on the time frame that you're entering the trade.
Right. So let me, now I want to ask you one last question, and then we're going to go into something else that's important because this is important. So one of the things that I looked on your site today and you have a trademark on this now, which is you've made the comment time and time again. This is, you're famous for this actually, Brian, which is it's only price that pays. Only price pays, right? Tell me what that means.
Wait. Good question. And I did trademark it. My wife told me I needed to protect this because a lot of people don't understand it. What it really means at the end of the day is we have all these analysis tools. We have these sentiment indicators. We have even, you know, my favorite indicator, the volume weighted average price. Those are reference tools that get us interested in why are we going to take the trade. There's no, hey, nice job. Good try this year, but you lost money. Go get them next year, kid. Your job is to make money.
Right.
So the only thing that matters at the end of the day is price action. Think back to Brexit. Think back to the election. It was the end of the bull market because Trump was elected. Mm-hmm. It was the end of the bull market because of Brexit. But we saw that those were quick knee-jerk reactions. And anyone who anchored their psychology on, hey, this president's going to be awful, I'm going to sell short the market.
Yeah,
well, they've
killed.
Lost a ton of money.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll right.
There,
so, So the only thing that matters, the market doesn't care what I think. It doesn't matter whether I think Apple's a good company or not. Apple will have another 50%, you know, down period probably in the next 2 to 3 years. It's done it. You know, it does it all the time. In fact, Amazon, I read that, you know, every year has had a 40% or greater pullback over the last, you know, since it's come public. The point is, if you get in at the wrong time, you can talk till you're blue in the face about what a good company it is. But if you're losing money, you're losing money. And right. That's not why we're in the market.
Right.
The only thing that matters at the end of the day is did I get it right on price action?
So now with that in mind, I read a lot of different other charting people. Some of them are really snarky and almost, I don't know, cocky on Twitter and they're, but they're focused on the charts, right? You know, I mean, really focused on the charts and that's it. But meanwhile, when it comes to things like Bitcoin cryptocurrencies, they're like, no way, man, that stuff is just, you know, I can't get near that. Meanwhile, there are charts on it, whether or not you like the thing, whether you not think it's going to stay around for very long, what's going on where some of the, those that only are technical analysts still stay away from this, and where are the opportunities?
Well, I think that, you know, the people who are technical analysts who stay away from it really need to examine what they think technical analysis means. It doesn't matter what the market is. What we're analyzing is the psychology of the participants. Can we gain an advantage by looking at the charts? I think that cryptos are one of the best products there is to trade technically. Number one, no one can tell you what the real fundamental is. And if you're trying to compare it to a stock with a PE ratio or cash flow or whatever, there is no fundamental comparison that you can make. But what we can do is understand the psychology of the participants. And now you've got all these, you've got tons of new hedge funds and, you know, coming in with big amounts of money. And these are people who've traded stocks. They're people who, you know, in some cases, brand new people. But we've got, you know, different ETFs popping up all the time, you know, regarded to the blockchain, not Bitcoin so much yet. They haven't approved those. But the point is that when there's no fundamentals, what do we have? We have crowd behavior. We have psychology. We have supply and demand. So if we can use some basic tools, and Andrew, it's moving averages. Fibonacci retracements has just been unbelievable in some of these markets. They come down to a 61.8% retracement to the penny and then have these tremendous, you know, 15 – 20% bounces. It's just it's unbelievable to see how well they trade technically. I think they're great trading products, and it's, you know, I think that the people who are closed-minded to them, as they say, you know, you shouldn't criticize something you don't understand. It's a closed mind that makes them have that viewpoint, and at that point, they're not doing what they claim they are.
So which particular cryptocurrencies do you follow and do you favor?
Well, I tried to coin a phrase. We have the FANG stocks, as you know. Everyone knows what those are. Yeah. Well, they're, you know, consistently some of the highest market capitalized cryptos are Bitcoin, of course, Ethereum, Litecoin, and then Ripple. So I said, what could be a good acronym? REBL, R-E-B-L. So Ripple, Ethereum, Bitcoin, and Litecoin form the REBL. And what a perfect – and the fact that it's not spelled R-E-B-E-L makes it more rebellious.
Yeah, like Holder, yeah. H-O-D-L. Hold,
H-O-D-L.
Yeah.
So I try to stick to those. Mainly, most of my trades have been I like trading Ethereum better than Bitcoin. So I think that I've done better with Ethereum as a trade. I was fortunate to get involved in Bitcoin in 2013 when I went to a Bitcoin conference in Las Vegas, actually, to check it out. I bluffed my way into getting a press pass. I bought some early on and held them really well. Not a whole bunch, but enough to be, you know, you don't have to hold a bunch of something that goes from 500 to 20,000 to make it worthwhile. But now it's my trades and my analysis for Alpha Trend subscribers is in the REBLs and mainly Ethereum and Bitcoin.
So it's interesting because it's easy to trade, for example, Bitcoin, Litecoin, and Ethereum on like GDAX, you know, or Coinbase if you have to. I mean, Ripple's a whole different animal, right? Ripple, you have to kind of move over to Binance or you move over to BitNex or you move wherever. And you got to do it through one of these coins, then sell it into Tether, then take the Tether and buy the Ripple.
Actually, at Poloniex, P-O-L-O-N-I-E-X, you can trade about, I think, 20 or so of the altcoins on a U.S. dollar cash basis.
Can you put money in?
Yes.
You can get money in there.
Well, you can put money in or you can, you know, what I did was actually I closed my Coinbase account. I don't like their commissions. I don't like their settlements. Right. I have an account at Gemini for Bitcoin and Ethereum. I think they're fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then I transferred Litecoins over to Poloniex, which was a simple thing. They were there in 15 minutes. And then when the time was right, I sold my Litecoins and then started dabbling in some of the little altcoins, or as they say, the SHIT coins. I don't know if you say it on the show.
Yeah, shit. Say it. Shit.
The shit coins.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny because I don't know if you ever checked out GDAX. GDAX is owned by Coinbase. Trading is perfect. You can trade without commission.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it's owned by Coinbase. You just have to like kind of go from same thing. It's almost like a separate entity, but same thing. You can actually very easily trade back and forth from your Coinbase account to your GDAX account. So what I did was I put money in my Coinbase account, moved it over to GDAX, and bought on GDAX.
Okay.
And you could. It all depends if you're a maker or a taker, depending on if you're forcing a trade in or if you're leaving it there, and it kind of is whether you're not paying. For the most part, I don't ever pay commissions.
Right.
Zero.
Oh, excellent.
So
okay, because Poloniex, it's 25 basis points as a taker, 15 as a maker.
Right. They're like, I'm not sure what it is, but maybe it's 15 as a – it's a zero and a 15, I think.
Okay. So that's great. You learn something. Anytime you talk to someone who has a little bit of knowledge about these things, you learn something new. Yeah. It's just crazy out there.
And I'm assuming – I'm making the assumption here, but you tell me if I'm wrong about this. But in terms of charting, because there's only select areas that you could do this, and if you go on the Poloniex or Binance or even GDAX for that matter, there's a limitation to how good their charting is and if it's really accurate. But TradingView has some of the best charts out there, right?
That's the number one trading or analysis platform, technical analysis platform for these cryptos. They've done a fantastic job of embracing these and really making a name for themselves. And it's a great charting platform, you know, even without the cryptos, but they've really embraced it early on and they're clearly the leaders here.
Right. So one of the things that I've noticed with these cryptos is that there's a couple of different things that you could do. This is less scientific, what I'm about to tell you. But flushes, we know what flushes are, right? So a flush of a price, I look at a lot of times 15-minute charts on these cryptos. So a flush on a price on a 15-minute with whenever that flush happens and a major spike of volume, okay, with a little bit of a retracement often leads to a significant rebound. Have you seen this?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you this too, Andrew. If you take a look at, okay, the last two big flushes, one, you can look back to I'll send you some charts of this a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But mid-September to the peak, what we saw was that mid-September, we had a pullback down to the 100-day moving average. We had a huge rally up towards 20,000, and then it pulled back to the 100-day moving average and the 61.8% retracement of that. The touch of the November 50-day moving average, if you go to the high, well, then on mid-January, that first flush, late December, that first flush came right down to the 50-day moving average. And like you said, on huge volume, and we saw a massive spike. But the Fibonacci, if you throw the Fibonacci in there as well, and just the 50-day moving average and this most recent pullback, mm-hmm. we're hovering right on the 100-day moving average. It's closed below it twice in the last 3 weeks since it's, you know, hovering in here. But yeah, absolutely. Those pullbacks are the way I just recently explained it on Alpha Trends, to say, here's how we're going to trade these things, is whatever amount of money that you've allocated towards cryptocurrencies, take a third of that and use it for these flush buys mm-hmm. that when they start flushing out, we're going to buy some on pullbacks. The other two thirds of it, we're going to buy based on actual technicals of the uptrends. So for instance, Ethereum right now is a true technical move here in the last 2 days. It's above the 10, 20, and 50-day moving average. Whereas Bitcoin, we're still down pretty good on the year so far. We're down, 2,000 points or so, or, 17, 18%. Whereas Ethereum right now is up, 60%, 12,000, so 1,200 rather. So there's definitely, the thing is, it's scary to buy those pullbacks. So you do it with a portion of your riskiest risk money. And then, if you're able to really get a true bottom, well, then you can, use that to hold on to your, longer term holdings that you really just want to put away.
Right. I don't know if Poloniex has NEO, but that's
they do. Yes.
Yeah. That's something that there's a couple of things about NEO that are really interesting. They actually pay you like a dividend.
I've heard that.
See, it's a gas charge. Certain wallets and all, and when you want to transfer and with the transaction fees, it's more of a gas. And anyway, there's a gas charge that comes along with it that is paid to you. But NEO is kind of interesting. I, when I looked at all the charts recently, especially with their pullbacks,
this looks really nice.
That's what I like about it. So,
talk about one of the stronger ones. Yep. We're, we've got a rising 10, 20, and 50-day moving average. It's just breaking some recent resistance here. And it looks like it's headed towards its new highs here in the near term.
Yeah, that's the one I'm holding on to right now. Got a chunk in cash because I'm just sitting on the side of some, but NEO I like. But all right, so we use the same kind of concept in time frames. We use the same psychology concepts in terms of moving averages, and now we're throwing in some Fibonaccis. Are there any, we talked about this pattern, about this big flush. What about, and how do you feel about these chat rooms and the news flow? I mean, for cryptos, I'll tell you mine and you can tell me yours, but basically you got to ignore that stuff and totally ignore it because there's a lot of crap that goes on in there.
Yeah. I don't look at any chat rooms. I don't need to see, I'll see what people are thinking in aggregate on the chart. I'm confident enough in my technical analysis abilities that I know what the sentiment is, and I know when to stand aside, and when to start to anticipate. You get these opinions and they cloud you.
Yep.
Now, my true opinion of some of these larger ones, Bitcoin and Ethereum, are that this thing is real. And I'm not one of these guys who thinks, you know, Bitcoin's going to 250,000 or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone knows what they're truly capable of, but I would be scared to death to short these things for any period of time. I view it as either you're in cash or you're long. For me, that's what works best. And I haven't found a good way to short them anyway.
Well, that's the other problem. If in the U.S., it's impossible. You can't even get margin in the U.S. for most of these. I mean, you could short it through either there's an ETF out there that's totally – it should be shorted, the GBTC, I think it's called, because right. The value is like one-third really. The NAV is one-third of what the price is. And you could do futures right now. But I agree with you that, you know, if you kind of have the mindset here that if you're going to trade it, you trade it from the long side only, then you don't have to think about the short side. So you're either out of it or you're going to be long and trying to either scalp or take a piece or maybe even play it for a longer term. Then you don't have to worry about the anxiety of this thing if it goes up all of a sudden out of nowhere like Ethereum did this year.
Yeah.
So
it was a beautiful breakout, basically January 1st.
Yep. So tell me, how can listeners find out more about your chart setups, your trading courses, trading rooms, your book, all that stuff?
Well, I'm not that out there, but I've got alphatrends.net. I've had that site for 11 years, and I provide, you know, my focus always has been, my primary focus, swing trades of U.S. equities. So alphatrends.net. I added crypto analysis this year because, you know, I've always kind of kept it off to the side for myself, but the liquidity's gotten so big. They've got the futures now. We've got these ETF products that there's enough liquidity that they can be managed. You know, the risk can be managed on the long trades in there. So my book is on Amazon, Technical Analysis Using Multiple Timeframes. And I think the best way to really get a feel for what I do is to follow me on Twitter at Alpha Trends.
Perfect. And then we'll wait for the movie.
The movie, yes.
Ryan Shannon, alphatrends.net. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. We'll have you on much sooner than we did this time in the terms of the span.
Always good talking to you, Andrew. Thanks for having me on again.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Bye-bye. Now, how about that for some great insights? Brian Shannon, awesome. Awesome, awesome. There's a lot to be learned in the area of technical analysis. And really, if you think about it for a second, one of the key items is that if you subscribe to using either only charts and technical analysis, or use it as a part of your overall investment research process, which I do, I think there is something to be said about how charts can actually be used without knowing the name of the company behind it, the fundamentals behind it. There is some trends that you could pick up on and you can actually trade effectively and efficiently. So really keep that in mind, that while some people say, oh, technical analysis, old voodoo. Yeah, I mean, some of the indicators are a little bit wonky. Some of the things that you know, cause signals, they could definitely be weird. But if you use some of the core basic principles of technical analysis and charting, I mean, I think there's a lot there that's, you know, useful. Before we got to talking with Brian, I mentioned that I spent some time this weekend reading. And in particular, I picked up a copy of Investor's Business Daily, which I like that paper, and Barron's. And you know my feeling on Barron's, generally speaking. It used to be a really good paper. It's kind of gotten a little bit, I don't know. For a long time, it was just I saw it as a cheerleading device, and everybody was just bullish on everything. And then it kind of changed a little bit. And some of the writers that I really liked left. Some of them passed away, unfortunately. And I stopped really digging down and reading this each and every week. Investor's Business Daily is both a weekly and a daily, and Barron's is a weekly. And the weekend edition is what I like for Investor's Business Daily. If you haven't read that, if you haven't, I have an opportunity to spend a little time. It is a pretty good resource. They have a significant bent towards growth investing, but some of their analysis and some of their tactics are pretty cool. So I would check that out. But here's what I got. First of all, from Investor's Business Daily, there was a list of the top brokers that... they did about 1,000 or so questionnaires and surveys on various brokers to readers, et cetera. And what was really cool was that TradeStation, you know, I really like TradeStation. They were the best for overall charting and equity trading tools, as well as of low commission. So they came in really strong, and they have for many years. Fidelity was the number one overall for customer service and the platform. Schwab, Interactive Brokers, and TD Ameritrade also rounded out the top five. So those were the top brokers. I mean, how many more are there really? I mean, it's not that many more, you know, full quote unquote full service, but there's a few more. But basically what I thought was great was, hey, we use TD Ameritrade. We use TradeStation. We use Schwab. We use Interactive Brokers. We don't use Fidelity. We had some experiences historically. I didn't like using their platform, the customer service from an institutional advisor standpoint. I wasn't thrilled with it. So, but what was really nice was to see that they recognized these five, and four of the five are the ones that we use regularly for clients and for portfolios. TradeStation we use primarily for our charting, for algorithms, for indications, for pricing of entries and exits, alerts. There's a whole host of things. Not to mention the fact that we actually power some pretty cool indicators on the TradeStation trading app store. So if you have TradeStation, you can get the trigger. We use the name Trigger Charts. You can go to TradeStation, the trading app store, and pick up the Trigger Charts. There's a bunch of them. There's a suite of indicators. There's also a key reversal indicator. There's the aileron indicator. There's an economic charting package that you can track about, I don't know, 35 different key economic indicators right inside of TradeStation. That one's free. But the other story I want to bring to you was about Barron's. I haven't really read this in a while. And it really surprised me in this weekly's discussion about how seemingly bearish they were in totality. I mean, yeah, there was a couple of really positive articles on a few things, and there were some, you know, things that were, you know, kind of questionable and negative. But generally speaking, when I kind of walked away from reading it from cover to cover, I said, oh, they were really pretty negative. I mean, talking about, hey, time to take chips off the table instead of this, buy some options and take your money out of that. And, you know, whole discussion by Schiller on the back page about, you know, hey, the CAPE ratio and really high and why is that? And there was, you know, the impending muni bond market implosion, and there was articles about just, you know, a lot of different things that seemed, I don't know, like the walk away and takeaway I got was, it was kind of generally kind of negative. But I thought that was interesting from the perspective that, you know, that's this was Barron's. Now, there were several general articles on all this, but there was one particular article that I found really fascinating, and I thought it was really well done, and it was regarding a company called Snap-on Tools. You've probably seen their trucks around. You've probably seen them around in general, and this is one of the best tool sets used for mechanics and a variety of other people out there. And trucks come around. You can buy from the trucks, or you can get things repaired. But what they discussed was pretty negative. They talked about the slowing sales growth of their core tool lines and reliance on the best way to describe it would be the internal financing they do. So they basically have a unit that finances all these high-level expensive tools for mechanics, et cetera. So they could pay, you know, $50 a week or $100 a month or whatever it is for their particular tools. But one of the problems is that while the financing division has put a tremendous amount of money into the overall revenue structure, about 27% now of their revenues from the financing division, their late payments are rising, the ratios are rising, and they have an elongated length of loans that they're offering. So now what happens is like, you can't afford this. All right, we'll do it over a 15-year period. And there's a lot of really interesting tidbits in this talking about, you know, what happens if all things stay good and, you know, mechanics keep on buying and everybody keeps on paying their bills and you know, they keep on coming up with new things that are needed and buy. Well, that's good. But already we're seeing a slowdown in purchases and in the revenues that are related to the core tool business. And while they have subsidized their overall revenue through this other means, and while it is possible that one day what they'll do is they'll just sell off the whole, leasing/financing division. That's possible. Who knows? There could be some real negative ramifications if we continue to see that the trend for late payments are rising. And when we're going from a, you know, a 30-day late to a 60-day late to a 90-day late, and that kind of keeps on spinning out of control. Very interesting discussion about Snap-on and something we're going to watch on key levels. There's a couple of key levels that we're looking at for the short side of this, and that's something that we're going to pay attention to. On that, we're going to end it on that note. Again, do me a favor and check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com, all the different strategies. And by the way, I'm just going to mention this, and I, you know, right now a lot of people are just kind of sitting around and saying, oh, things are great, we're not going to do anything. Well, don't wait till it's too late to look at other strategies. Strategies that may go both short and long, or maybe diversify you a little better. All the information about how we do what we do and the various strategies, whether it's a TDI managed growth strategy, Arrow, Investology, or global allocations, all on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check that out. Don't wait. At least do the research now, so when it's time, if it's time, when it's time, you'll have something to, you'll have some knowledge and a kind of a head start on all this. If it ever becomes a time that you want to kind of change what you're doing. Other than that, thank you so much for joining me, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.